And tomorrow in the final episode, can Simon gather the evidence to prove who the killer is and stop more murders?
From betrayals and battlefields,
Richmond and victory!
To the birth of a golden age.
What is her name? Elizabeth.
200 years of the English crown, as told by Shakespeare, Marlowe and their contemporaries, moves towards its epic finale.
Violence!
Narrated by Richard Burton and starring Sean Phillips and John Gielgud, Vivat Rex continues on Radio 4 Extra, weekday mornings from 10 and again in the afternoons at 3.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Well, let's continue this crime and thriller hour with the first of a two-part tale from the casebook of Sherlock Holmes. A Nightmare in Cornwall is remembered by Dr. John Watson, and it's read by James Nickerson.
The Devil's Foot by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Episode 1. In recording, from time to time, some of the curious experiences and interesting recollections which I associate with my long and intimate friendship with Mr. Sherlock Holmes, I have continually been faced with difficulty caused by his own aversion to publicity. To his sombre and cynical spirit, all popular praise was always abhorrent. And nothing amused more at the end of a successful case than to hand over the actual exposure to some orthodox official and to listen with a mocking smile to the general chorus of misplaced congratulation. It was indeed this attitude upon the part of my friend, and certainly not any lack of interesting material, which has caused me of late years to lay very few of my records before the public. My participation in some of his adventures was always a privilege, which entailed discretion and reticence upon me. It was then with considerable surprise that I received a telegram from Holmes last Tuesday. He has never been known to write where a telegram would serve, in the following terms. Why not tell them of the Cornish horror? Strangest case I have handled. Well, I have no idea what backward sweep of memory had brought the matter fresh to his mind, or what freak had caused him to desire that I should recount it. But I hasten, before another cancelling telegram may arrive, to hunt out the notes which give me the exact details of the case, and to lay the narrative before my readers. It was then, in the spring year of 1897, that Holmes's iron constitution showed some symptoms of giving way in the face of constant hard work of a most exacting kind, aggravated, perhaps, by occasional discretions of his own. In March of that year, Dr. Moore Agar of Harley Street, whose dramatic introduction to Holmes I may someday recount, gave positive injunctions that the famous private agent would lay aside all his cases and surrender himself to complete rest if he wished to avert an absolute breakdown. The state of his health was not a matter in which he himself took the faintest interest, for his mental detachment was absolute. But he was induced at last, on a threat of being permanently disqualified from work, give himself a complete change of scene and air. Thus it was that in the early spring of that year we found ourselves together in a small cottage near Poldhu Bay, at the farthest extremity of the Cornish Peninsula. It was a singular spot, and one peculiarly well suited to the grim humour of my patient. From the windows of our little whitewashed house, which stood high upon a grassy headland, we looked down upon the whole sinister semicircle of Mount's Bay, that old death-trap of sailing vessels, with its fringe of black cliffs and surge-swept reefs, on which innumerable seamen have met their end. With a northerly breeze, it lies placid and sheltered, inviting the storm-tossed craft to tack into it for rest and protection. Then comes the sudden swirl round of the wind, the blustering gale from the southwest, the dragging anchor, the lee shore, and the last battle on the creaming breakers. The wise mariner stands far out from that evil place. On the land side, our surroundings were as sombre as the sea. It was a country of rolling moors, lonely and dun-coloured, with an occasional church tower to mark the site of some old-world village. In every direction upon these moors, there were traces of some vanished race which had passed utterly away, and left as its sole record strange monuments of stone, irregular mounds which contained the burned ashes of the dead, and curious earthworks which hinted at prehistoric strife. The glamour and mystery of the place, with its sinister atmosphere of forgotten nations, appealed to the imagination of my friend, and he spent much of his time in long walks and solitary meditations upon the moor. The ancient Cornish language had also arrested his attention, and he had, I remember, conceived the idea that it was akin to the Chaldean, and had been largely derived from the Phoenician traders in tin. He had received a consignment of books upon philology, and was settling down to develop this thesis, when suddenly, to my sorrow and to his unfeigned delight, we found ourselves, even in that land of dreams, plunged into a problem at our very doors, which was more intense, more engrossing, and infinitely more mysterious than any of those which had driven us from London. Our simple life and peaceful, healthy routine were violently interrupted, and we were precipitated into the midst of a series of events which caused the utmost excitement not only in Cornwall, but throughout the whole of the west of England. Many of my readers may retain some recollection of what was called, at the time, the Cornish Horror, though a most imperfect account of the matter reached the London press. Now, after 13 years, I will give the true details of this inconceivable affair to the public. I have said that scattered towers mark villages which dotted this part of Cornwall. The nearest of these was the hamlet of Tredanick Wallace, where the cottages of a couple of hundred inhabitants clustered round an ancient moss-grown church. The vicar of the parish, Mr. Roundhay, was something of an archaeologist, and as such, Holmes had made his acquaintance. He was a middle-aged man, portly and affable, with a considerable fund of local lore. At his invitation, we had taken tea at the vicarage, and had come to know also Mr. Mortimer Tregennis, an independent gentleman who increased the clergyman's scanty resources by taking rooms in his large, straggling house. The vicar, being a bachelor, was glad to come to such an arrangement, though he had little in common with his lodger, who was a thin, dark, spectacled man with a stoop, which gave the impression of actual physical deformity. I remember that during our short visit we found the vicar garrulous, but his lodger strangely reticent, a sad-faced, introspective man, sitting with averted eyes, brooding, apparently, upon his own affairs. These were the two men who entered abruptly into our little sitting-room on Tuesday, March the 16th, shortly after our breakfast hour, as we were smoking together, preparatory to our daily excursion upon the moors. "Mr. Holmes," said the vicar in an agitated voice, "the most extraordinary and tragic affair has occurred during the night. It is the most unheard-of business. We can only regard it as a special providence that you should chance to be here at this time, for in all England you are the one man we need." I glared at the intrusive vicar with no very friendly eyes, but Holmes took his pipe from his lips and sat up in his chair like an old hound who hears the view halloo. He waved his hand to the sofa, and our palpitating visitor, with his agitated companion, sat side by side upon it. Mr. Mortimer Tregennis was more self-contained than the clergyman, but the twitching of his thin hands and the brightness of his dark eyes showed they shared a common emotion. "Shall I speak, or you?" he asked of the vicar. "Well, as you seem to have made the discovery, whatever it may be, and the vicar to have had it second hand, perhaps you had better do the speaking," said Holmes. I glanced at the hastily clad clergyman with the formally dressed lodger seated beside him, and was amused at the surprise which Holmes's simple deduction had brought to their faces. "But perhaps I had best say a few words first," said the vicar, "and then you can judge if you will listen to the details from Mr. Tregennis, or whether we should not hasten at once to the scene of this mysterious affair. I may explain, then, that our friend here spent last evening in the company of his two brothers, Owen and George, and of his sister, Brenda, at the stone house of Tredanick Wather, which is near the old stone cross upon the moor. He left them shortly after 10 o'clock, playing cards around the dining-room table, in excellent health and spirits. This morning, being an early riser, he walked in that direction before breakfast, and was overtaken by the carriage of Dr. Richards, who explained that he had just been sent for on a most urgent call to Tredanick Wather. Mr. Mortimer Tregennis naturally went with him. When he arrived at Tredanick Wather, he found an extraordinary state of things. His two brothers and his sister were seated round the table exactly as he had left them, the cards still spread in front of them, and the candles burned down to their sockets. The sister lay back stone dead in her chair, while the two brothers sat on each side of her, laughing, shouting, and singing, the senses stricken clean out of them. All three of them, the dead woman and the two demented men, retained upon their faces an expression of the utmost. most horror. A convulsion of terror which was dreadful to look upon. There was no sign of the presence of anyone in the house except Mrs. Porter, the old cook and housekeeper, who declared that she had slept deeply and heard no sound during the night. Nothing had been stolen or disarranged, and there is absolutely no explanation of what the horror can be which has frightened a woman to death and two strong men out of their senses. There is the situation, Mr. Holmes, in a nutshell. And if you can help us to clear it up, you will have done great work. I had hoped that in some way I could coax my companion back into the quiet which had been the object of our journey. But one glance at his intense face and contracted eyebrows told me how vain was now the expectation. He sat for some little time in silence, absorbed in the strange drama which had broken in upon our peace. "I will look into this matter," he said at last. "On the face of it, it would appear to be a case of a very exceptional nature. Have you been there yourself, Mr. Roundhay?"
Oh, no, Mr. Holmes. Mr. Tregennis brought back the account of the vicarage, and I at once hurried over with him to consult you.
How far is it to the house where this singular tragedy occurred?"
About a mile inland."
"Then we shall walk over together. But before we start, I must ask you a few questions, Mr. Mortimer Tregennis."
The other had been silent all this time, but I had observed that his more controlled excitement was even greater than the obtrusive emotion of the clergyman. He sat with a pale, drawn face, his anxious gaze fixed upon Holmes, and his thin hands clasped convulsively together. His pale lips quivered as he listened to the dreadful experience which had befallen his family, and his dark eyes seemed to reflect something of the horror of the scene.
"Ask what you like, Mr. Holmes," he said eagerly. "It's a bad thing to speak of, but I will answer you the truth.
Tell me about last night."
Well, Mr. Holmes, I supped there, as the vicar has said, and my elder brother George proposed a game of whist afterwards. We sat down about 9 o'clock. It was 10:15, and I moved to go. I left them all round the table as merry as could be.
Who let you out?"
"Well, Mrs. Porter had gone to bed, so I let myself out. I shut the hall door behind me. The window of the room in which they sat was closed, but the blind was not drawn down. There was no change in door or window this morning, nor any reason to think that any stranger had been to the house. Yet there they sat, driven clean mad with terror, and Brenda lying dead of fright with her head hanging over the arm of the chair. I'll never get the sight of that room out of my mind so long as I live."
"The facts, as you state them, are certainly most remarkable," said Holmes. "I take it that you have no theory yourself that can account for them?"
"Oh, it's devilish, Mr. Holmes. Devilish!" cried Mortimer Tregennis. "It's not of this world. Something has come into that room which has dashed the light of reason from their minds. What human contrivance could do that?"
"I fear," said Holmes, "that if the matter is beyond humanity, it is certainly beyond me. Yet we must exhaust all natural explanations before we fall back upon such a theory as that. As to yourself, Mr. Tregennis, I take it you were divided in some way from your family, since they lived together and you had rooms apart."
"That is so, Mr. Holmes, though the matter is past and done with. We were a family of tin miners at Redruth, but we sold out our venture to a company and so retired with enough to keep us. I won't deny that there was some feeling about the division of the money, and it stood between us for a time, but it was all forgiven and forgotten, and we were the best of friends together. Looking back on the evening you spent together, does anything stand out in your memory as throwing any possible light upon the tragedy? Think carefully, Mr. Tregennis, for any clue can help me."
"There's nothing at all, sir."
"Your people were in their usual spirits?"
"Never better."
"Were they nervous people? Did they ever show any apprehension of coming danger?"
"No, nothing of the kind."
"You have nothing to add, then, which could assist me?"
Mortimer Tregennis considered earnestly for a moment.
"There is one thing that occurs to me," said he at last. "As we sat at the table, my back was to the window, and my brother George, he being my partner at cards, was facing it. I saw him once look hard over my shoulder, so I turned round and looked also. The blind was up and the window shut, but I could just make out the bushes on the lawn, and it seemed to me, for a moment, that I saw something moving among them. I couldn't even say if it were a man or animal, but I just thought there was something there. When I asked him what he was looking at, he told me he had the same feeling. That is all I can say."
"Did you not investigate?"
"No, no, the matter passed as unimportant."
"You left them then, without any premonition of evil?"
"None at all."
"I'm not clear how you came to hear the news so early this morning."
"I'm an early riser. Generally take a walk before breakfast. This morning I'd hardly started when the doctor in his carriage overtook me.
He told me that old Mrs. Porter had sent a boy down with an urgent message. I sprang in beside him and we drove on. When we got there, we looked into that dreadful room. The candles in the fire must have burned out hours before, and they'd been sitting there in the dark until dawn had broken. The doctor said Brenda must have been dead at least 6 hours. There was no sign of violence. She just lay across the arm of the chair with that look on her face. George and Owen were singing snatches of songs and gibbering like two great apes. Oh, it was awful to see. I couldn't stand it. And the doctor was as white as a sheet. Indeed, he fell into a chair in a sort of faint, and we nearly had him on our hands as well. Remarkable. Most remarkable, said Holmes, rising and taking his hat. I think perhaps we had better go down to Jordanic Wather without further delay. I confess that I have seldom known a case which at first sight presented a more singular problem. Our proceedings of that first morning did little to advance the investigation. It was marked, however, at the outset by an incident which left the most sinister impression on my mind. The approach to the spot where the tragedy occurred is down a narrow, winding country lane. While we made our way along it, we heard the rattle of a carriage coming towards us and stood aside to let it pass. As it drove by us, I caught a glimpse through the closed window of a horribly contorted, grinning face glaring out at us. Those staring eyes and gnashing teeth flashed past us like a dreadful vision. "My brothers," cried Mortimer Tregennis, white to his lips. "They're taking them to Helston." We looked with horror after the black carriage lumbering on its way. Then we turned our steps towards this ill-omened house in which they had met their strange fate. It was a large and bright dwelling, rather a villa than a cottage, with a considerable garden which was already, in that Cornish air, well filled with spring flowers. Towards this garden, the window of the sitting room fronted, and from it, according to Mortimer Tregennis, must have come that thing of evil, which had by sheer horror, in a single instant, blasted their minds. Holmes walked slowly and thoughtfully among the flower pots and along the path before we entered the porch. So absorbed was he in his thoughts, I remember that he stumbled over the watering pot, upset its contents, and deluged both our feet and the garden path. Inside the house, we were met by the elderly Cornish housekeeper, Mrs. Porter, who, with the aid of a young girl, looks after the wants of the family. She readily answered all Holmes's questions. She had heard nothing in the night. Her employers had all been in excellent spirits lately, and she had never known them more cheerful and prosperous. She had fainted with horror upon entering the room in the morning and seeing that dreadful company around the table. She had, when she recovered, thrown open the window to let the morning air in and had run down to the lane when she sent a farm lad for the doctor. The lady was on her bed upstairs if we cared to see her. It took four strong men to get the brothers into the asylum carriage. She would not herself stay in the house another day and was starting that very afternoon to rejoin her family at St. Ives. We ascended the stairs and viewed the body. Miss Brenda Tregennis had been a very beautiful girl, though now verging upon middle age. Her dark, clear-cut face was handsome, even in death, but there still lingered upon it something of that convulsion of horror which had been her last emotion. From her bedroom, we descended to the sitting room where this strange tragedy had actually occurred. The charred ashes of the overnight fire lay in the grate. On the table were the four gutted and burnt-out candles, with the cards scattered over its surface. The chairs had been moved back against the walls, but all else was as it had been the night before. Holmes paced with light, swift steps about the room. He sat in the various chairs, drawing them up and reconstructing their positions. He tested how much of the garden was visible. He examined the floor, the ceiling, and the fireplace, but never once did I see that sudden brightening of his eyes and tightening of his lips, which would have told me that he saw some gleam of light in this utter darkness. "Why a fire?" he asked once. "Had they always a fire in this small room on a spring evening?" Mortimer Tregennis explained that the night was cold and damp. For that reason, after his arrival, the fire was lit. "What are you going to do now, Mr. Holmes?" he asked. My friend smiled and laid his hand upon my arm. "I think, Watson, that I shall resume that course of tobacco poisoning which you have so often and justly condemned," said he. "With your permission, gentlemen, we will now return to our cottage, for I am not aware that any new factor is likely to come to our notice here. I will turn the facts over in my mind, Mr. Tregennis, and should anything occur to me, I will certainly communicate with you and the vicar. In the meantime, I wish you both good morning. It was not until long after we were back in Poldhu Cottage that Holmes broke his complete and absorbed silence. He sat coiled in his armchair, his haggard and ascetic face hardly visible amid the blue swirl of his tobacco smoke, his black brows drawn down, his forehead contracted, his eyes vacant and far away. Finally, he laid down his pipe and sprang to his feet. "It won't do, Watson," said he with a laugh. "Let us walk along the cliffs together and search for flint arrows. We're more likely to find them than clues to this problem. To let the brain work without sufficient material is like racing an engine. It racks itself to pieces. The sea air, sunshine and patience, Watson. All else will come. Now, let us calmly define our position, Watson," he continued, as we skirted the cliffs together. "Let us get a firm grip of the very little which we do know, so that when fresh facts arise, we may be ready to fit them into their places. I take it, in the first place, that neither of us is willing to admit diabolical intrusions into the affairs of men. Let us begin by ruling that entirely out of our minds. Very good. There remain three persons who have been grievously stricken by some conscious or unconscious human agency. That is firm ground. Now, when did this occur? Evidently, assuming his narrative to be true, it was immediately after Mr. Mortimer Tregennis had left the room. That is a very important point. The presumption is that it was within a few minutes afterwards. The cards still lay upon the table. It was already past their usual hour for bed, yet they had not changed their position or pushed back their chairs. I repeat, then, that the occurrence was immediately after his departure and not later than 11 o'clock last night. Our next obvious step is to check, as far as we can, the movements of Mortimer Tregennis after he left the room. In this there is no difficulty, and they seem to be above suspicion. Knowing my methods as you do, you were, of course, conscious of the somewhat clumsy water-pot expedient by which I obtained a clearer impress of his foot than might otherwise have been possible. The wet, sandy path took it admirably. Last night was also wet, you will remember, and it was not difficult, having obtained a sample print, to pick out his track among others and to follow his movements. He appears to have walked away swiftly in the direction of the vicarage. If, then, Mortimer Tregennis disappeared from the scene and yet some outside person affected the card players, how can we reconstruct that person and how was such an impression of horror conveyed? Mrs. Porter may be eliminated. She is evidently harmless. Is there any evidence that someone crept up to the garden window and in some manner produced so terrific an effect that he drove those who saw it out of their senses? The only suggestion in this direction comes from Mortimer Tregennis himself, who says that his brother spoke about some movement in the garden. Now, that is certainly remarkable, as the night was rainy, cloudy, and dark. Anyone who had the design to alarm these people would be compelled to place his very face against the glass before he could be seen. There is a 3-foot flower border outside the window, but no indication of a footmark. It is difficult to imagine, then, how an outsider could have made so terrible an impression upon the company, nor have we found any possible motive for so strange and elaborate an attempt. You perceive our difficulties, Watson.
Yes, they are only too clear, I answered with conviction.
And yet, with a little more material, we may prove that they are not insurmountable, said Holmes.
I fancy that among your extensive archives, Watson, you may find some which are nearly as obscure. Meanwhile, we shall put the case aside until more accurate data is available, and devote the rest of our morning to the pursuit of Neolithic man. I may have commented upon my friend's power of mental detachment, but never have I wondered at it more than on that spring morning in Cornwall, when for 2 hours he discoursed upon Celts, arrowheads, and shards as lightly as if no sinister mystery was waiting for his solution. It was not until we had returned in the afternoon to our cottage that we found a visitor awaiting us, who soon brought our minds back to the matter in hand. Neither of us needed to be told who that visitor was. The huge body, the craggy and deeply seamed face with the fierce eyes and hawk-like nose, the grizzled hair which nearly brushed our cottage ceiling, the beard, golden at the fringes and white near the lips, save for the nicotine stain from his perpetual cigar. All these were as well known in London as in Africa and could only be associated with the tremendous personality of Dr. Leon Sterndale, the great lion hunter and explorer. We had heard of his presence in the district and had once or twice caught sight of his tall figure upon the moorland paths. He made no advances to us, however, nor would we have dreamt of doing so to him, as it is well known that it was his love of seclusion which caused him to spend the greater part of intervals between his journeys in a small bungalow buried in the lonely wood of Beecham Arriance. Here, amid his books and his maps, he lived an absolutely lonely life, attending to his own simple wants and paying little apparent heed to the affairs of his neighbours. It was a surprise to me, therefore, to hear him asking Holmes in an eager voice whether he had made any advance in his reconstruction of this mysterious episode. "The county police are utterly at fault," said he, "but perhaps your wider experience has suggested some conceivable explanation. My only claim to being taken into your confidence is that during my many residences here, I have come to know this family of Tregennis very well. Indeed, upon my Cornish mother's side, I could call them cousins, and their strange fate has naturally been a great shock to me. I may tell you that I got as far as Plymouth upon my way to Africa, but the news reached me this morning, and I came straight back again to help in the inquiry." Holmes raised his eyebrows. "Did you lose your boat through it? I'll take the next." "Dear me, that that is friendship indeed. I tell you, they were relatives." "Quite so. Cousins of your mother. Was your baggage aboard the ship?" "Yes, some of it, but the main part at the hotel." "I see. But surely this event could not have found its way into the Plymouth morning papers?" "No, sir, I had a telegram." "Might I ask from whom?" A shadow passed over the gaunt face of the explorer. "You are very inquisitive, Mr. Holmes." "It is my business." With an effort, Dr. Sterndale recovered his ruffled composure. "I have no objection to telling you," he said. "It was Mr. Roundhay the vicar who sent me the telegram which recalled me." "Thank you," said Holmes. "I may say in answer to your original question that I have not cleared my mind entirely on the subject of this case, but that I have every hope of reaching some conclusion. It would be premature to say more. Perhaps you would not mind telling me if your suspicions point in any particular direction." "No, I can hardly answer that." "Then I have wasted my time. I need not prolong my visit." The famous doctor strode out of our cottage in considerable ill humour, and within 5 minutes Holmes had followed him. I saw him no more until the evening, when he returned with a slow step and haggard face, which assured me that he had made no great progress with his investigation. He glanced at a telegram which awaited him and threw it on the grate. "From the Plymouth Hotel, Watson," he said. "I learned the name of it from the vicar, and I wired to make certain that Dr. Leon Sterndale's account was true. It appears that he did indeed spend last night there, and that he has actually allowed some of his baggage to go on to Africa while he has returned to be present at this investigation. What do you make of that, Watson?"
"He is deeply interested."
"Deeply interested, yes. There is a thread here which we have not yet grasped, and which might lead us through the tangle. Cheer up, Watson, for I am very sure that our material has not yet all come to hand. When it does, we may soon leave our difficulties behind us."
Tomorrow, there's even more death. Holmes and Watson sift through the evidence and even set up their own experiment. Part one of The Devil's Foot by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was read by James Nickerson and produced by Joanne Reardon for BBC Manchester. Poetry 2012. The Written World.
I am Sonia Senatore. I am Italian, from Rome. And the poem I am going to read is The Dream of the Mother by Stefano Dal Bianco. Se state guardando una madre che dorme in poltrona in un qualsiasi dopo pranzo invernale. If you are watching a mother sleeping in an armchair on any winter afternoon siesta with the television temporarily off, and in the house, the imperious peace of an achieved family history. Stay there, don't go, and cover her with a shawl. When I first read it, I was just quite amazed because it conjured up the perfect picture of my mother, and it kind of just gave me a sensation that I had to go and see her and put that shawl over her shoulders, because I just imagined her sitting there on her couch, cozily sleeping on a Sunday afternoon, perhaps. And I just felt, I have to go there. So I actually did go and buy a ticket to see her. And I'm actually just back. And so I'm so grateful that you gave me the opportunity to read this poem, which so much relates to my personal life. Restate lì, non ve ne andate, e copritela con uno scialle.
Poetry 2012, The Written World.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 2 o'clock. Good morning from me, Jim Lee, and welcome to an hour of comedy for the early hours of Tuesday. In the castle next, the love that dare not speak its name, and the love that can speak its name but can't pronounce it. A little in-flight entertainment at 2.30 and Cabin Pressure this morning making their way to Limerick. And then three very different women, Pam, Kate and Rosemary, set off on a trip that stirs up a range of hopes and fears at 4 o'clock. Now, we invite you once again to travel back in time, about 700 years actually, for another episode of The Castle.
We present The Castle, written by Kim Fuller and Paul Alexander. This week on The Castle, a murder, a mystery and a makeover.
Here's your breakfast, sire.
Oh, thank you, Bates. Oh, these eggs aren't cooked.
The cooking of the eggs is the responsibility of the Lieutenant Kitchen Skivvy's below stairs undercook, my lord.
But we don't have a below stairs undercook, do we, Bates?
No, sire. So I undercooked the eggs myself.
Morning, Henry.
Whatever, Peter, dude.
Why are you so grumpy? It's the first day of the school holidays.
Yeah, but there's nothing to do in the holidays, innit?
Well, if you're bored, you could read a book to improve your vocabulary. In it. The Bible. Or that stirring tale of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
Nah, books are boring. I'd only read one with, like, killing and murder and slaughtering and that.
Well, the Bible it is, then.
Morning, Father.
Morning, Anne, Charlotte. You're both very chirpy.
Yes, well, summer is here and a band of travelling players has arrived at the Merck Inn with a new production.
Really? What kind of production?
Oh, it's a kind of reality entertainment following the lives of real people.
Sounds ghastly. What's it called?
The Only Way is Wessex.
So what is it? Is it a comedy, a tragedy?
A sort of in between. They call it a trashedy. They're auditioning today.
Sounds banging. I'm going to go down and meet these guys.
They want real people, Henry, not morons.
I am real for real.
Well, as the Lord Chamberlain's representative for moral standards in the theatre, I'd better see what's going on. I must say the phrase reality entertainment makes my heart sink to my boots.
We'll come with you, Father.
Oh, wait for me!
What shall I do with the eggs, sire?
Why don't you put them, as the phrase has it, where the sun don't shine?
Why would you put eggs in the cellar?
My lord, I see you are reading a book.
And why is that such a surprise to you, Duncan?
Because, sir, the only thing I've seen you read lately is the obscene graffiti on the wall of the water closet at the Merck Inn. Most of it written in your hand.
Well, I'm hoping this book might give me an insight into the female mind.
Yes, well, I don't know much about the female mind, sire, having been brought up in the church, where the status of women is a smidgen above that of the devil himself.
Ah, this book is very useful. Until today, the only thing I knew about women was that they are more expensive in Paris than in Constantinople. In fact, once you cross into Asia, you can usually get a bog-off.
And what, pray, is a bog-off?
Buy one, get one free.
Oh, I wonder if that applies to men.
Why on earth would you wonder that?
So, what is this erudite and wondrous work of literature that gives such a deep understanding of the female psyche?
It's called Twilight.
Twilight?
Yes, yes, Duncan. This is the first in a series. The next is Getting Quite Dark, then Breaking Dawn, then Quite a While After Dawn, but still about 20 minutes before breakfast, and my favourite one of all...
What's that?
Afternoon Nookie.
And what are they like?
Absolute rubbish. But they do carry a very interesting message. You see, they're all about a girl who falls in love with a vampire but cannot have him without herself becoming a vampire and thus destroying her life.
And what message does that give out, apart from the fact that women are batty?
The message, my little cassock-wearing chum, is that women desire men whom they cannot have. And in order to gain Lady Anne's heart, I must become remote, mysterious, and unattainable.
Given that your feelings for Lady Anne announce themselves in your britches, like the billowing sails of a schooner announce the approach of a gale,